We live in a time of catastrophes. Virus pandemics, climactic cataclysms, species extinction, terrorism, political upheaval. It begs the question, what can we do? We can touch the jaguar. New York Times bestselling author and activist John Perkins is here with us today to discuss how we can change our realities by changing our perceptions. Thank you all for joining me for a very personal story about transitioning fear into action. Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Impact Earth Mindful Living. So the big question for this show is, how do we move from where we are now, as our guest describes, living in a death economy, to a thriving life economy, which so many of us are hungry for and might even say starving for? And what part do each of us play in transforming our life and our world? John Perkins has quite a few thoughts he will share with us about that. But first, I'd like to share with you a bit more about our guest for a number of reasons, including his journey from helping to create a death economy to being passionate and a champion for changing our world, because he's doing just that. John Perkins is an author and an activist who has authored 10 books on global intrigue, shamanism, and transformation, including Touching the Jaguar, Shapeshifting, and the classic Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list for way more than 70 weeks, sold over 2 million copies, and it was published in, has been published in 35 languages. As chief economist at a major consulting firm, he advised the World Bank, the United Nations, Fortune 500 corporations, and the United States and other governments. Now, John regularly speaks at universities, economic forums, and shamanic gatherings around the world, and is a founder and board member of the nonprofit organizations, the Pachamama Alliance, and Dream Change. And I know he has started other nonprofits as well. So quite a journey, to say the least, John Perkins. And little did you know, until we spoke just before we got on the air, that I have been wanting to get you to myself since I met you and read your first, the first book I read was a book about going to the Amazon and taking ayahuasca. And I don't remember the name of it, but then I read Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I have pored over, reread, and dog-eared Touching the Jaguar. So thank you for being here, and I'm glad that I get you to myself. And let me just add that we have very clear intentions with our shows, and the intention of Impact Earth Podcast is to get the authentic viewpoint of an expert on a particular issue, which to me, with yours, is mindfulness. It really is. And what you know that our listeners don't, and in my case, and in their case, I'm sure it's a whole heck of a lot. So my whirling dervish brain put things kind of in three buckets so that it wasn't a three-hour interview, which it could easily be for me, and I would stay interested. But I'd like to talk about your journey as an economic hitman and how that led you to becoming a visionary for how we heal the planet and move from a death economy to a thriving life economy and our roles in that. And then, last but not least, I really want to get your thoughts on COVID, because one of the passages I want to read for the book was right after the shaman story, when you talk about the payoff and disease epidemics, which there weren't any like that in my lifetime. So let's start with bucket number one, your latest book, Touching the Jaguar. It's an in-depth look about your life as an economic hitman and then moving into the person that you are now. So what does it mean? Let's start there.
Well,
that's a big, bold question, I know, but you can talk for the next 15 minutes and I won't interrupt you.
Well, thank you so much, Gina, for that wonderful introduction. And it's great to be with you. I'm really glad that we're doing this. It's so fun. You know, I guess I should start by saying when I first learned about Touching the Jaguar, and that was back in 1969. I was a Peace Corps volunteer deep in the Amazon rainforest with the Shuar people, and you were recently with the Achuar, who were their neighbors. There were Shuar in that community too. So these people live deep, deep in the rainforest. And I was sent there by the Peace Corps in late 1968. they were still living a very, very down-to-earth lives, let's say, what a lot of people would call primitive. I learned that that's not a very applicable word, actually. But they were living lives of hunters and gatherers. And at one point, after being there a short period of time, I got very sick. I was dying. I couldn't keep any food down. I lost a tremendous amount of weight in a very short period of time. I couldn't even stand up without help. And to get to the nearest medical facility would have been a three-day, very, very difficult journey, including a whole day of hiking through dense jungle. And then another 2 days of riding in a rickety old wooden bus up terribly curvy roads to 10,000 feet up into the Andes. Like, there was no way I could do it. So I was resigned to dying. But one night, a shaman offered to cure me. Now, this is 1969 now, early 69, and I've just graduated from business school. I've never even heard of a shaman. I have no idea. This man looked very strange. He had tattoos all over his face. You know, he was indigenous, and he was wild-looking and scary even. But what am I going to do? I got no other options. So I agree to it. So that night, he took me on a shamanic journey, and it was ayahuasca was involved, and I drank some ayahuasca. I had no idea, never heard of ayahuasca. I had no idea what I was drinking, something very, very bitter, and it tasted terrible, but so did a lot of medicines that my parents had given me as a kid. And so, okay, but suddenly, I'm in this trance state, and I'm seeing these weird images, and I'm vomiting a lot, but nothing's really coming up because I'd vomited a lot for the last week. So there was nothing unusual
empty.
About that.
That's worse.
Yeah. Yeah. But I suddenly I see this amorphous shape in front of me. I've got my eyes closed. And the shaman says, "Touch the jaguar." Well, it's nighttime in the middle of the jungle. And I open my eyes and I look all around like, "Where's the jaguar? Help us, you know?" And he says, No. Close your eyes and see the jaguar and touch it." So I closed my eyes and this amorphous shape shifted into a jaguar. And I heard a voice say, "The food and drink will kill you." It was like my mother's voice. And at that moment, I realized that I grew up in rural New England, New Hampshire, very bland foods, Yankee Calvados for over 200 years in that part of the country. And suddenly I'm eating some very strange foods, squirming white grubs that you pull out of a rotting log and down the hatch, you know, as they squirmed out.
Ew,
your throat.
I did not have to do that when I went.
What a shame. You would have loved it. And no. You probably did drink some chicha. Did you drink some chicha?
Lots.
Yes. So chicha, which is, for those who don't know, the people in the Amazon don't drink river water because they know it's not safe. You know, the rivers are filled with organic matter, falling trees and dead animals and so forth. So the women make a kind of beer called chicha by chewing manioc root and spitting it. And then you can mix water with it because it's alcohol. It's delicious, isn't it, Gina?
I love that you're telling this story because it brought me right back to being at the tribal chief's gathering. And two of the people sitting next to me that I'm still friends with are saying, I can't, I just can't. You're first, Gina. You have to try it. And there was no way I was not going to try it. And you know, it wasn't bad. It's the concept, the thought that you're drinking someone's spit is what I was saying to myself. But it doesn't
exactly taste
like that. So I did it a lot.
What does spit taste like anyway?
I know. Anyway. It doesn't have any taste. Well, but chicha does.
Yes. Anyway, so I'm drinking a lot of spit beer because you got to rehydrate in the Amazon. You know, it's the tropics. And as you know, and there wasn't anything, you know, and I'm eating a lot of squirming white grubs and things that I'm not even going to talk about.
Good. I'm really glad.
Yeah. Well, you know, in your trip, we also, on these trips, we have purified water that we take with us. So you had that option.
Right. I was on a luxury trip, relatively. Yeah. I wasn't on a luxury liner with flush toilets, but it was different than your trip. So different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And, you know, on the trips that I do now to the Maya, to the Kogi, to the Achua and the Chua, we're very careful to make sure that people have you know, good food and water, but and including vegans and vegetarians. But this was not
a trip.
I've been a Peace Corps volunteer, and I've been deserted by the Peace Corps, basically by the U.S. government. I've been deserted. I'm in the Amazon, deep in. Anyway, there weren't any cliff bars. There wasn't any Perrier. So I'm eating a lot of strange foods and drinking a lot of Chicha spit beer. And every time I realized on that shamanic journey that every time I ate these foods or drank this spit beer, I heard a voice saying, "It'll kill you," and my mother. At the same time, I saw how incredibly healthy the Shwa are. You've seen them, Gina. The men are built like Rambo, you know,
totally.
Tarzan. And the women, while I was in my early 20s, the women were looking pretty good, you know.
They still look pretty good.
Yeah. And the people live to be very old if they don't die in a hunting accident or something. And so that night, I realized that it wasn't the food and drink killing me. It was my perception of the food and drink, my mindset. And after that, the next day, I was better. And a couple of days later, the shaman came up to me and he said, you know, you owe me. And his way, it was a totally bargain, you know, society. It was, you know, your bananas for my papayas. There was no money. They had no currency. And so I couldn't imagine what I needed to pay him. But he told me, he said, "You need to become my apprentice." Mm. And I had no interest at all. As I said, I'd never even heard of a shaman. It was 1969. I graduated from business school. There was no future in shamanism.
There was not really a lot of job description for it either.
No. In fact, you know, later when I became a chief economist and economic hitman, I couldn't even admit to knowing shamans because I would have been ridden out on a rail from those organizations. But in any case, the guy saved my life, so I didn't have much choice. So I became his apprentice. And one of the first things he taught me, he said, you know, touching the jaguar means that you see what it is that's blocking you. You see your fears. You see your blockages. And instead of running from them, you touch them. And when you touch your fears or your blockages, they help you change your perception. And you realize that reality is molded by perception. I mean, he's given me these very sophisticated ideas. And once you understand that, then you can change your reality. And you know, Gina, after that, I spent 3 years in the Peace Corps. It's a two-year program, but I extended for a year. I studied, the last year I was up in the Andes with the Quechua shamans, and I studied with them. And then later, when I was an economist, I'd take time out in Indonesia, in Iran, in Egypt, and all over the world, and it's all over Latin America and North America, and study with shamans every chance I got. Here I am, an economist. I can't talk about this, but I'm doing it. And you know, the common thread throughout shamanism all over the planet is that our perceptions mold our reality. When you think about it, there's no United States, there's no Mexico, there's no culture, there's no religion, there's no corporations, there's no economy until we perceive them. And when enough people accept a perception or codify it into law, it has a huge impact on reality. That's shamanism, but it's also quantum physics. It's also modern psychotherapy. And it's modern marketing, it's corporations, it's selling perceptions that then change people's realities. But that was, you know, I'd been to business school, but we didn't learn that. We learned about how you can use marketing, but it really wasn't the philosophical side. It was a brilliant moment of enlightenment for me that stuck with me ever since, this knowledge that we can change reality by changing perception. And that's why Touching the Jaguar, the book goes into those stories, but it also is about how we've created a death economy, an economic system that's consuming itself into extinction, that's causing terrible environmental destruction, climate change. It's responsible for things like a lot of the violence in the world, the terrorism. The pandemic is based on all of that. So much of it is. But it's all based on a perception of what success means, the maximization of short-term profits. I can get into that more if you want, but it's all based on a perception. And to turn that into a life economy, that's an economic system that's based on paying people, paying investors, paying workers to clean up pollution, to regenerate destroyed environments, to recycle, to invent and develop technologies that don't ravage the earth, but in fact renew the earth, And in other words, it's based on the premise that the goal is long-term benefits for people and nature rather than short-term profits for a few wealthy individuals, regardless of the social and environmental costs. And all we need to do to make that transformation from a death economy that we know is failing us to a life economy is change our perception of what it means to be human and to be successful humans on this planet. Now, it sounds simple, and it is. It's change of perception. That's the first step. And then, of course, we have to start thinking about what actions we take in order to make that happen. So there's more to the process, but it starts with that change of perception. And for each of us as individuals, it's the same. If, you know, for many years I resisted being a writer because I had a perception that I was a lousy writer. That's another story. But so in order to start really writing, I had to change that perception. And we can all look at that now, the perception that we have is we have a pandemic. Oh, my gosh, I'm in self-isolation. I can't handle it for another week or month or year or whatever it's going to be.
Right.
But if we can turn that around and say, ah, but this gives me the opportunity to read all those books I wanted to read or to write a book or to learn to play the flute, go online and learn to play the flute or whatever it is. Once we change that perception, we change our own reality.
And I just want to kind of inject here that when I read the book, Your Economic Hitman, totally different experience from Touching the Jaguar, obviously, but you wove a lot of your journey as an economic hitman into that. And what keeps coming up for me as the message, and when I usually read a book preparing for a show, there's like 100 yellow stickies and ask him this and underline this and read this. And I didn't want to do that when I read this book because it was kind of like a gift to me to go deeper, and I would stop and I'd put it down. I was in Taos, so my hectic life was not in full operation because of COVID, one of the blessings you talk about. But so much of what you're saying, when you get the visual of Touching the Jaguar, is we live in a fear-based world. John, I was so scared that I was going to vomit my guts out and poop my pants on the ayahuasca journey. And some people didn't do it because of that. And then I thought, you know what? Forget this. What's the worst that can happen? And it doesn't happen for everybody, but it was fear. And I did it anyway. And everything that could happen to me. And I started laughing hysterically. It's like, so what? This is part of my cleansing. And the I call them the guardians that stayed with me to assist me to get to the quote unquote bathroom spot in the jungle that they didn't want me to, you know, fall in the hole. I was so happy. And part of that happiness was my greatest fear was that. So when I read Economic Hitman, my first thing that kept coming up is, why is John not dead? I'm sure that you had those thoughts. I mean, why did they not take you out? Because they took out presidents of entire countries, and you're here pulling off the Band-Aid and saying, yeah, look what this sore has under it. And then with the shaman story and all of the things in the book are not about going to the Amazon and touching the jaguar. It's about sitting in your own head like I was about this show. It's like, what are you afraid of? This is not some man that you have to be scared of. He wants you to go deeper and figure out your own stuff. So fear, watching the debates last night, think of what a tactic that is in politics. Fear, 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 fear. That's what I kept hearing. And it's because I read the book that it kind of puts it in a place of that's not true. That's just fear-based. Well, that's not true. They're just trying to scare us. So to me, the metaphor is so applicable now more than it ever has been. And you know, I wanted to ask you, and I knew we would kind of go all over the place because of my whirling dervish brain, but when you wrote this book, it came out in June, but you started it a long time ahead of that. Did you think that we would be talking here today and 210,000 people would have died from a pandemic? Like, did you, through your shamanic journey, know that dark days were coming? It's, you know, I love Game of Thrones. Winter is coming. And I thought, God, when I read that about pandemic, who knew? I never would have believed it. It was just for Hollywood movies. So fear, how much of this is just facing our own fears? Because if you go deeper, you know what the right thing to do is.
Yeah, Gina, so you've said a lot there. I think, let me go back first to the idea, the fear you had about vomiting and pooping your pants. And that's so common. And I've taken probably well over 1,000 people over the last 20 years into the Amazon and done ayahuasca there, many of them. And I could say about ayahuasca, it's a cool plant and it can be very enlightening, but there's many other ways to reach that enlightenment. People do not have to take that plant to reach that.
And most people won't, let's be honest.
And that's another story. But, you know, there's so many ways to do that. And I address that in Touching the Jaguar at the end of the book, a daily practice. It's about 10 minutes a day or 10 minutes a week, whatever you want to do, that does the same thing. But anyway, you know, that fear of vomiting, and it's so, and the indigenous people, the Shwa, the Achua, the War, all the Amazonian people that use ayahuasca, they just think that's hilarious that people fear that, because for them, that is a purge, as you mentioned. It's getting rid of bad energy. It's part of the process. And, you know, some of these tribes, which are now classified as nations, have a custom of getting up every morning and taking something called wayusa, this tea that they take that just makes them vomit every morning. And they all do it. And they say, they'll tell you this, that, you know, they eat their last meal around 5 in the afternoon because they go to bed shortly after sunset, which on the equator is it's about 6:30 every day. And then they get up around 4 or so and take, or 3, and take this wayusa. And they say that they do that because if whatever they have in their stomach shouldn't be there then, that their body has taken care of all the nutrients and everything that it needs to during that time between 5 in the afternoon and 4 the next morning. And so they're getting rid of things that the body wants, that does not want. It's not like, you know, those diseases that we have here where people force themselves to vomit because they don't want to gain weight or something. It's not at all like that.
No.
It's about, and so for them, vomiting and diarrhea, for that matter, are getting us healthy. They're not being sick. They're being on the road to health. But that's just a different perception.
Yes.
Different perception.
Yes.
And so let's see, that was one of your one point, but so the other, let's see about...
I really socked it to you. Like, yeah, are you surprised that you're still alive? That was one of the things that came up.
All right, let's go into that one then. So, you know, after I quit being an economic hitman, when I did it for about 10 years, and at the early years, I thought I was doing the right thing because what I was doing was convincing heads of countries to accept huge loans from the World Bank or sister organizations, but the money went to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in the country that had taken on the loan. Things like power plants and industrial parks and roads and highways and so forth. And our companies made tremendous profits out of that. And the nation that, you know, had taken on the loan and never saw the money actually paid our companies, the money went to our companies. A few wealthy families did very well as a result of these projects, the ones that own industry, banks, and commercial establishments, and the industrial parks. But the country went deep into debt, and it hurt everybody else. But it took me a long, because money was taken away from education, healthcare, and other social services to pay off the interest on the debt. And in the end, the debt couldn't be repaid. And so we'd go back in and say, hey, since you can't pay your debt, sell your oil or whatever the resource of that country was that we'd identified real cheap to our corporations without environmental or social regulations. Let us build a military base on your soil, privatize and sell your schools and your water and sewage systems and utility companies to our investors, et cetera, et cetera. That was the game. But at the beginning, I thought it was the right thing, because in business school, you learn that if you can increase the GDP of a country, everybody is better off. And you do increase the GDP when you build these infrastructure projects. But over time, I saw that GDP really only measures the wealthy people. And we can see that even in the United States today, there's three individuals who have as much wealth as half the U.S. population.
I know.
if those three individuals made 10% return on their investments last year and half the population lost 3%, we'd still show a gain in GDP of something around 5%. So I began to see over time that these statistics, GDP is a terrible statistic. It does not measure a country's prosperity. It measures the prosperity of the wealthy, just like the stock market. But it took me a long time to realize that, because I'd been trained in business school and the World Bank and everybody else says, no, everybody's getting better. GDP per capita, which is a meaningless number, really. Statistically, it's meaningful, but in reality, it's meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. And from a standpoint of overall prosperity, that is to say. And so once I realized this, I got out after 10 years, and I started writing a book about everything that I'd done. And I decided to make it an expose, and I called other people that had my job, like an economic hitman. And there's another line of people that if presidents didn't accept these loans, and they knew this would happen because they'd seen it happen in other countries, people we call the jackals would go in. These are CIA assets, usually, who overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders, as they did with Salvador Allende in Chile, Mossadegh in Iran, Lumumba in the Congo, Arbenz in Guatemala, Diem in Vietnam, and on and on. We've admitted to these things. So I started contacting other economic hitmen and jackals to get their stories. And immediately I started receiving anonymous phone calls threatening my life and that of my infant daughter. And so, you know, and I took these calls very seriously because I knew some of these guys. I knew what they'd done in other countries. In fact, two of my clients, Jaime Roldós of Ecuador, president of Ecuador, and Honor Torrijos, head of state of Panama, were both taken out because they did not accept the deals I offered them. So I took it very seriously. At the same time, I get taken out to dinner by the president of Stone & Webster Engineering Company, which was a big competitor of my company that I just retired from. And he takes me out to dinner and he says, hey, you know, you've got a great resume. You were chief economist of one of our competitors. You had a staff of 50 people, blah, 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 blah. We'd like to use your resume in our proposals. You don't have to do any work. Just let us use your resume in our proposals. And I'm prepared to write you a check tomorrow morning for $500,000. This is in the late 80s. $500,000 is worth a lot more than it is today. And it's nothing to sniffle at today.
No, that's for sure.
So I'm getting the same deals that I've been giving presidents of countries. It's kind of like, here, accept this deal and you'll get a lot of money. Or if you don't accept it, the guys with the guns step in. So I'm being hit the same way I've hit others. And I have to say, you know, I did what most presidents do, with a few exceptions, like the two I mentioned, and I didn't write the book. But I did take the money that he paid me and used it to start these nonprofits. You mentioned two of them, Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance. I went back to the Amazon. I went back to many of these other countries. I founded these nonprofits, and I wrote 5 books on indigenous people and shamanism, et cetera. The World Is As You Dream It, Shape-Shifting, Psychonavigation, and so forth. And that was fine with them that I did that. But I did not write the book that I wanted to write about what I'd done as an economic hitman. And then eventually 9/11 hit. By then my contract with Stone & Webster was over. And I went in the Amazon on 9/11 with a group of people, very much like the group you were on. But when we come out, I fly up to New York. I have to see this ground zero. I don't know why, but I'm attracted to it. I was living in Florida at the time. As I stood there looking down into that pit, I knew I had to write this book, which isn't to say that I make any direct connection. It's not to comment on what happened on 9/11. It's simply to say that I was inspired, motivated, whatever, to say, I've got to tell the story now. But I decided that I wouldn't tell anybody I was going to tell the story. I wouldn't contact other people. I wouldn't write an expose. I'd write a personal story, a confession, just my life. And I do it totally in secret. And once I had the whole book written, no proposals, nothing like I'd done with some of my earlier books, I got in the hands of a very good New York agent. At that point, I figure it's my insurance policy. Because once the book is written, once it's out there, if something strange happens to me, the jackals know that that's the worst thing that they can do is do something to me that'll make me a martyr and sell lots and lots of books.
But John, so, when you go ahead, I'm just
no,
like,
so it's so
yeah.
You know,
so
I just like
going.
To say, anybody thinking about being a, anybody's thinking about being a whistleblower, don't threaten to blow the whistle. That's really dangerous.
Blow the whistle.
Blow the whistle. Get everything ready and get it out in the hands of somebody who can really deal with it, like a literary agent and publishing houses to have it, and will do something with it if something happens to you. And that's your best protection.
Well, and the reality is to be able to do what you're doing now and have the impact that you're having and the thoughtfulness that you're inviting us to all do the end of your book, what you can do. You couldn't have done it without the full transparency of the first part of your life. I mean, you really were living a double life. You were doing all these things that you thought were helping, maybe, and then going to the Amazon and to other places and having very deep spiritual journeys. And it was amazing to me. It's like, yeah, it's like a made-for-TV movie where you're living in this world and then you come back and live in this world. And they couldn't be more polar from where I sit. So what about, I just wanted you to describe to us what colonialism really means, because that stuck out for me. We don't even use that word other than when the 13 original colonies. Who even uses that word? But what we did was colonize these countries. When I read the parts about the two Democratic presidents, it was Ecuador and Panama, they just killed them. In very similar, you know, accidents, plane crashes, and we colonize. We just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. So talk about the concept of colonialism. It's enthralling to me.
Yeah, well, you know, colonization can take many forms. As you pointed out, you know, the colonization of America, when people come in from another place and settle. But they also then take advantage of the local populations. There's tremendous exploitation. And it can take the form of physical exploitation, killing people or enslaving people, commandeering their resources. But there's also a mental side of it, of doing everything you can to bring the people around to your way of thinking. So, for example, in the United States, I mean, one of the worst things that we did with indigenous people here, well, we did a lot of bad, terrible things. We killed them. We brought them diseases. But then once that we sort of justified later on that we sent them to reservations and we tried to colonize their minds by forcing them to only speak English, to not use their own languages anymore, to not use their cultures and traditions, not do their dances. That's coming back. It's been coming back for the last 20 years or so, but they've been consciously trying to bring that back, the indigenous people. But so colonization is really, it can be physical destruction, but it's also mental and spiritual. And yeah, that's very much what, unfortunately, the United States, it's really been our corporations that have driven this, have done around the world, of colonizing the world to a form of capitalism that I and a lot of other economists call predatory capitalism. So capitalism can take many forms. I don't want to get too technical here, but you know, little markets, farmers' market is capitalism. The markets all throughout Latin America and indigenous communities, that's capitalism. My grandson's lemonade stand is capitalism. You know, and the definition of capitalism basically is that it's when the means of production and commerce are owned by individuals, not by the government, and there's free and open competition. So we don't really have that anymore. Yes, the means of production in the United States are not owned by the government for the most part, but the people who own the means of production own the government. So it's been a reversal here. The big businesses, as we know, nobody gets elected to a high office in this country without the support of lots of money. And the competition has basically been really squelched by the big monopolies or opalopolies, big businesses that control huge amounts of our economy and drive the small guys out of business if it's to their advantage to do so. And so what we have is something we call predatory capitalism. And that has colonized the world, or the attempt was made to colonize the world with that. And it was very successful in many places, like in Latin America. That's basically what I was doing as an economic hitman. And, you know, what it's really created, because this particular form of economics is based on the premise that the only responsibility of business is to maximize short-term shareholder profits. Yep. In other words, profits for a few rich individuals, regardless of the social and environmental costs. That is the driving force. That's what everybody learns in business school. That's what Wall Street expects everybody to do, maximize short-term profits. And that idea has been used to colonize the world, bring that concept everywhere. And it's created a fiasco. It's created a failed global system, this death economy. It's behind the horrible fires that we're experiencing throughout the United States, Australia, the Amazon, so many places, the hurricanes, the earthquakes, the once in 100 year events. You mentioned earlier, Gina, that when I wrote the book, did I know that there was a pandemic coming? No, although some people had said that was happening, and some of the indigenous people were saying, we're going to have something like this. So yes, there was that thought out there.
Right.
But more importantly, perhaps, at the time I wrote the book, before the pandemic, was that I knew that already we were having these once in 100 year events every year, every day almost. I mean, we're constantly, these once in 100 year catastrophes were happening constantly. And that was something that all the prophecies had prophesized if we didn't change. If we didn't move to, as the Eagle and Condor prophecy says, to bringing our heart and minds together, to not just focusing on the science and the industry, which is the eagle of the mind, and but to also bring in the emotion, the passion, the environmental knowledge that's in the heart, and bring those two together. If we didn't do that, we would have catastrophes. And of course, that's what we've been experiencing. A major difference is that with earthquakes and hurricanes and fires, this message was coming through very strongly that we needed to change. But people were taking it as a local message. So if I survived the hurricane, I expected the outside world to come to my help.
Right.
Bring in bottled water and food.
Right.
But now, the pandemic has shown us that this is global. Every single human being on this planet, in fact, every species in one way or another, is being impacted by this pandemic. And so the message of Pachamama, Mother Earth, however you want to look at it scientifically or shamanically, however you want to look at it, there's a very, very strong message here that we have to change. Or if not, the next thing that hits us, whether it's another pandemic or whatever it is going to be a lot worse.
And you, what you do through your words is get me out of the dark hole and going over to the dark side, because I don't want to live in fear. There are many wonderful things that have come about as a result of this pandemic, which I'd like to talk about towards the end of the show. But I want to read one part of the book. And I would like you to start to preface that by just telling the shaman story, because that is one where I put a big yellow sticky and I have this way of noting things and I have stars around it. But can you tell the story? And I don't know if it is a Chumbi, a Shuar elder, and shaman. People love stories, and that was a really great story. And then I want to read a little bit of what the paragraph you kind of translated it for us. So what's the Chumbi story? It's a really powerful story.
Well, Chumbi was a teacher of mine. He was Shuar. And I'm not sure. I tell lots of stories about Chumbi, so I'm not sure which one you're referring to.
Well, in the book it says they were giant white cannibals who lived deep in the forest. We, the people, never went near where they lived. And he's telling it to children. They were afraid they might come to our community.
Right. Right,
so that's that. It's that story.
the Evia story.
Yes.
So what most people who live like the Shuar, the Achuar, or many of the others do, they don't have electricity, they don't have television, they don't have radios. At night, they do tasks. The women make chicha, the men are making darts for their blowguns, for whatever. And the elders are telling stories for the children. And they also do this early in the morning. And one of their most important stories, and it's common, and similar stories are common in many, many cultures, including where I grew up in New Hampshire, the Abnaki, part of the Algonquin nation. They have a similar legend, which is interesting. But this particular story is that the Shuar, the Achuar, lived very peaceful lives, but they knew that up in the mountains beyond them were the Evias, and these are giant white cannibals. But the Evias left them alone for a long, long time, and then one day the Evias came down and started killing and eating the Shuar, the Achuar. And they couldn't, they were great warriors, but they couldn't do anything. The Evias were huge. If they put their spears against them or shot them with blowguns, it didn't hurt them. It just broke the spears. So there's nothing they could do. And they were terribly frustrated and terribly frightened. And then one day, this great warrior came down the river in a canoe with two other men. And this one warrior, he glowed. He was huge and he glowed. And he said, "I'm here to save you from the Evias." And they didn't believe him. But he said, "I've got to go alone up into the mountains and meet the Evias. Nobody can go with me, not even my own men. I got to do this alone." And he went off up into the mountains and he was gone for days. And they all assumed he had been killed. And they expected the Evias to come back. But instead, he came back one day, late in the afternoon, and he said, "You know, I've worked a deal with the Evias. They say that they won't come down and attack you and eat you anymore. But you have to provide, the men have to provide them with your choicest meats when you go hunting. And the women have to give them lots of chicha and the vegetables that you grow in the gardens, the fruits and vegetables." And the Shuar said, "Well, okay, we'll do that." And they did. But soon they started to starve because they couldn't keep up with the demand of the Evias. And so this great warrior's name was Etsa. And Etsa then comes to them and he says, "I can teach you how to get rid of the Evias permanently, but there's got to be an exchange here. You've got to promise to do something for me." And they said, "Well, yeah, anything." And he said, "Well, have you noticed that your populations, until the Evias came down, were growing and growing and growing, and you were destroying the forests, and you were hunting all the animals. You were cannibalizing nature the way the Evias were cannibalizing you. You have to stop doing that. And you have to, I'll teach you some methods of birth control, but if you don't practice those methods of birth control, then you need to go to war with each other periodically to cut down your populations." And he says, "It's just like you women weeding your garden, the gardens. You have to weed out people if you don't do it." And they said, "Well, we'll practice birth control." And so Etsa taught them how to put poison in the chicha, how to lay traps, how to do various things, and they get rid of the cannibals, the Evias. And then Etsa went up into the sky, became the sun. And so the sun to this day is known as Etsa. It's a very pretty story.
It's a beautiful story.
Yeah. But what happened then later is they kept their populations down, actually. And some of it did involve warfare. But then the missionaries came in and the schools came in and said, "You can't use birth control." And the missionaries said, "You can't use birth control." And vaccinations came in and populations grew and grew and grew. And they're saying that today the oil companies and all that's going on of the destruction of the forests around them, the mining companies now, there's a lot of mining companies, including big Chinese companies and Canadian companies going in into gold mining and copper mining and destroying the environment there with cyanide and mercury and everything. And they're saying now that, well, it's because they couldn't get their populations down that Etsa has come back. And because they didn't keep their promise. And we are the great white cannibals, and we are, they're as you know, Gina, they're short people. They're very muscular, they're very strong, but they're much smaller than us in many ways, and typically on average. So they're saying, you know, the great white cannibals, and they also say the oil derricks and the big mining equipment, that's all part of the Evias.
And John, it's like when I'm back in the rainforest when you talk about the people and things that I noticed. I definitely talk a lot. I'm a good listener as well. But I didn't want to talk a lot in the rainforest. And when I did, what I noticed about, I noticed so many things, but the Achuar and the people in the tribal people, they speak softly. Because they are guests in the forest. They live one with the animals. So they speak softly. They tread lightly. They use everything. And, you know, I think a lot of people have a perception of, you know, you can use the word savages. It's not used very much anymore. Primitive is a word you used. Poor. And for 2.5 weeks, I sat there thinking, they're anything but. Is their life hard? Yes. Would I be willing to live it? No. I do not want to get up every day and have to go get catfish to eat for tonight. But in terms of joy and happiness and living in concert with nature and all of that balance and respect for where the human role is, it just, you know, that's what keeps feeding my soul in that. But the story, what you wrote about, is, I want to read it. After reciting it, Chumbi always looked around at those who had been listening, which usually was mostly Shuar children. You must ask yourself, he would say, about the Evias in your life. What scares you? What are you doing to hurt the plants and animals and other people? What must you do to change this? Realize that each of you has your own Evias. Each of you is Etza. Know that sometimes you must dive deep inside your heart to confirm your Evias. You must do this alone. No one can help you. Only by doing that will you avoid going to war with yourself. And why did I star that? Because that's the deal. We have to, like, go personal responsibility, go deeper, and figure all this stuff out. Like, what do we want our world to look like? And then go forth and be that person. And nobody can do it for us. Like, I wanted to call people before this interview with you. And I think, what the hell is up with that? No, you don't. There's things that you've been dying to ask John Perkins and you get him on the show. So stop it. But that's a fear based of inadequacy and not going deeper. So I told you what I did. I went and meditated and picked the rabbit card, which is, there's a message there from me and my story and how important that is for people to realize. It has never been as bad in the world, as far as I'm concerned, on so many levels. I'm getting ready to write a blog about climate refugees, and I'm calling it a different kind of refugee. Because most people, when you say climate refugees, they're like, what? And that's the whole global lack of global connection. But things are really not good, and it's okay to say that, because there is a lot that's good. There's a lot of hope. And which side do you want to go on? It's, you know, a story about which wolf do you want to feed, the good one or the bad one? And your book inspired me, and I've had people, I called friends and I said, I want to have a one book club. Will you order Touching the Jaguar? And they did. And so we've had major discussions about what that means. And these are like, we would be classified as old, white, middle-class women, because I'm going to be 70, and we're still thinking and contributing and wanting to make a difference for our children and our grandchildren. So what do you think about that line, you will do it only by going, you will only by doing that will you avoid going to war with yourself? Do you want to elaborate on what that it was like a bam? What does that mean to you, John Perkins?
Well, yeah, you know, like legend, and Joseph Campbell was a master at talking about how these stories that we tell ourselves and stories that Indigenous people tell are all part of psychoanalysis, really, psychotherapy.
Yes.
That was why, and I emphasize, it was important that Etza said, I've got to go up into the mountain to meet the Evias by myself.
By
I
myself.
Can't take anybody with me.
Yep.
And that's life, you know. When Merlin, the magician, you know, in King Arthur's court, instructed the Knights of the Round Table to go out and find the Grail, which is really basically about finding ourselves, he said, you get to start by going alone to the darkest place in the forest, the scariest place you can find, in a place where there are no trails. And then you've got to go into the forest there to look for the grail. You've got to enter into the place where there are no trails. Nobody's gone before you. Only you can do it. Only you can do it. And I think that's so important, you know, and especially in this day and age when we so often look for others to do it, or we think of ourselves as victims. And, you know, I'm very concerned with all these conspiracy theories that are out there, because basically those conspiracy theories are telling us, hey, it's beyond my control. There are these powers that are so much stronger than me. I can't do anything. They come from other planets. They come from out under the earth, or they're the deep state, or whatever it is. And I wrote a newsletter about that that'll come out today or tomorrow. If people want to get it, just go to my website, johnperkins.org, and sign the little box there with your email about you know, about this very subject. And so, yes, we each have to do it. And, you know, at the end of the book, Touching the Jaguar, there's this daily practice. But you don't have to do it every day. You can do it once a week if you want, however often you want. It only takes maybe less than 10 minutes. But it's based on five questions that go into that. And I think they're the same five questions that pop up to us almost subconsciously when we're on ayahuasca, when we do something else. And do you want me to mention the five? Do we have time? I don't know what
time
it is.
We have time, and that's what I wanted to say to you. We'll probably... We can take as much time as we want. That's why I have my own company, my own podcast. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. But I think it's critical, even if we end with that and you come back at some point because COVID's going to be with us and talk about COVID, these five questions, what people need is hope and tools and concrete ways to get a handle on all of this. And that... In the section under resources, what you can do, we need to hear that. And I'd love you to go through the five of them because they're really powerful. And I started journaling. I've never journaled ever. It's like so boring and I think so much faster than I can write. And I was like, no, you don't have to run away to a 7 o'clock meeting. You can stay in bed, do your meditation and journal. And it's transformative. I can't believe the stuff that comes out of my pen. You know what I mean? So talk about that. Yes, I think we should end with that. What can I do? It's the up note. It's the call to action.
Yeah. Well, so the daily practice is in the book. This gives you a little outline of maybe an easier way to do this. But I'm going to talk about the five questions. So the first question we ask ourselves is, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? What will bring me the greatest joy? The greatest satisfaction. Again, going back to Joseph Campbell, what would bring me the greatest bliss? If I knew I only had a year left in my life, what would I do with it? And that means, well, what should I do now? What would bring me the greatest satisfaction? And as an example, I'll say for me, that is, I'd say I'll write because I love to write. I love to write books, and I'm working on another one right now.
You love it.
5 or 6 hours a day because I love to do it. You know? And I have a good friend who's a carpenter. And for him, the answer is, well, I want to work with my hands and wood. It's kind of almost the opposite end of the spectrum from writing.
You know? He wants to build things.
Yeah. So, but anybody can answer that question, however you want to answer it, you know. And what do I want to do for the rest of my life? It'll bring me the greatest satisfaction. The second question is, how can I do that in a way that will serve others? Because we're all happy when we serve others. And that could be one other person, or it can be the entire world. So for me, I would answer, well, I want to write about things that will help people transform their lives. So the subtitle of Touching the Jaguar is Transforming Fear into Action to Change Your Life and the World. So I want to write about things that help people do that. For my carpenter friend, he'd say, well, I want to use sustainable materials. I want to make the world a better place for my children and grandchildren. I want to use sustainable materials. And the third question is, what's the jaguar stopping you? What gets in your way? What's the obstacle? What's the fear? What's stopping you from doing those two things? And for me as a writer, I might answer, well, I just don't have enough time to write. That might have been my answer at one point. I don't have enough time to write. I'm too busy doing other things. For my friend the carpenter, it's, well, my clients don't want to pay more money to buy sustainable materials. I can't even talk about that to them. I'm afraid to talk to them about it. They'll turn them off. And so the fourth question is, when you touch that jaguar, how does it change your perception? And so for me, the jaguar says, well, heck, you know, get up a half an hour earlier or watch an hour less of television every night and write, or 3 times a week, whatever. But set aside something. You can find the time. The time's there. Find it. And for my friend the carpenter, the Jaguar says, well, tell your clients that the extra price they may pay for sustainable materials is not a cost. It's an investment in the future for them and their children, for the future. Tell them that. And so the fifth question then is, what actions do I take every day? And so for me, the writers, I got to write every day, you know,
does not magically write itself. Do the work.
You got to take actions. And for the carpenters, you go out and carpentry and use sustainable materials and talk about it. You don't have to be poetic, but just say, hey, kids, look, your mom and dad hired me to make this cabin or build this house for you, and they paid a little bit more for sustainable materials, but that's an investment in your future. They did this for you. And, you know, so those questions again, one, what will bring me the greatest satisfaction for the rest of my life? How can I do that in a way that will serve others? To those two. Three is what's stopping me. Four is when I touch the Jaguar, how does it change my perception so that I can move forward through the blockage? And five, what actions do I take? And you know, those, Gina, those last three questions will change frequently. So, you know, what's stopping me? Well, okay, so I've set aside an hour every night. I'm not going to watch television for three nights a week. I'm going to write. But now the next question is, what am I going to write about?
Right.
Then that takes you to, you touch that Jaguar, and the Jaguar says, well, look, I know what you want to write about. You want to write about what you did as an economic hitman, or you want to write about what it's like to be a mother, bringing a kid up during the pandemic, or whatever it is. And then the fifth question, what actions do you take? Those three questions and your answers will change frequently. But every time they change, it means you've moved to a higher level of consciousness about yourself, who you are and what you want to do. It means you've touched another Jaguar. You've broken through another barrier. You've moved to a higher level of consciousness, and you've come much closer to satisfying what it is you want to do for the rest of your life. And so to do this frequently, and you journal, I love that you're journaling on it, because to write these things down can be very helpful. And that's part of what the daily practice tells you to do. But again, you only need to do this for 10 minutes or a little less frequently.
I know. And I used to think, oh my God, it takes too long. And then I thought, well, I'll just type it. Well, it's not the same. It's just not the same. Typing it is not the same, because I can type much faster than I can write. And sometimes I can't read my own handwriting. But there's something that comes over you, that gets in you, that I'm just writing it for me. Nobody's going to read those. I told my daughter, if anything ever happens to me, I said to my daughter, Emily, I said, just get the journals, because it's nobody's business. I don't want them out there. And it's not like some deep, dark secret about the five affairs I'm having, but it's like just...
God, that's a lot of affairs.
I know, I'm really busy.
How do you keep up with that?
And during a pandemic.
But yeah, with mass.
I want to go back to this, because here's the thing. Those questions might be why I started journaling. I'm not sure why. I'm going to be 70 in December, and so now I'm starting to journal. I used to say to my friends, you got to be kidding me. I don't have the patience. I don't have blah, 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 blah. But one of the questions that you asked that is such a different spin on it, who or what has been colonized in me? So that was like a bam, it got lots of stars around it, lots of circles, lots of arrows, which is how I show my joy when something hits me. Because what you unearth, what stories do I tell myself? Why would I be afraid of talking to you? What in me said, you're not adequate, he's so much smarter than you, he's gone a lot more ayahuasca journeys. The committee was erupting. They're like coming in, and finally I said, just shut up, everybody. I'm not listening to any of you. I'm going on this one from my heart. And I'm sharing that because it makes me transparent, and it makes me hopefully touch the people that listen to this show and take it seriously and listen to the end and share it, that we all have things colonized in us. And the more we can dig them up and either like them, embrace them, and say, thank you for that, because my mother always said, you're a leader. Regina Mary, you're a leader. If she would literally say this, John, if Carolyn jumps off the Brooklyn Bridge, are you going to follow her? My mother used that line on me. So if enough of your mother tells you enough times you're a leader, you kind of figure that out eventually. You start believing it. But there are other stories that are colonized in me that I keep uncovering, and I dare say I probably will till I die. And you helped me with a lot of that, you know, what did colonize me? And I don't want this interview to end. It's like Tuesdays with Maury, only Thursdays with John Perkins. And I want to go on, but I think we should stop. And I hope that you'll come on another time and we can have some fun and conversation. And I am going to get off this mic and go look at your trip, because that's what happens with me. My friend said, do you want to come and visit me in Bali? And I went, you bet I do. And now I'm starting a project to help the people that are starving there by just gathering wool, literally, from friends of mine that knit and from the Goodwills to send wool to them, because that will be a lifeline. They can make things and sell it in other parts of the world. So is there anything else that you want to say and end with? Or I wish you would have asked me this, Gina.
I guess I would just say, get back to the trip. I think, you know, Bali is a huge commitment. I love Indonesia. I've spent time there. Lived there for a while, but Guatemala is a hop, skip, and a jump from the United States, and you're in Arizona, I think.
I know.
Almost next door. And so it's an easy trip. But yeah, what I would like to say is I would like your listeners to know that we are all very blessed to live at this time. And it may not seem that way sometimes, but this is a huge period of transformation. I like to call it a consciousness revolution. People around the planet are waking up to the fact that we live on a very fragile space station, the Earth. And we're the pilots. Human beings are the pilots. And we've been navigating the space station toward disaster. We need to reboot the navigation system. We need to repilot. And we're in the process of doing that. People around the world are waking up to this. And this virus is a real kick in the butt that's taking us to another level of waking up to this, I hope. Now, there'll be those, whenever there's a revolution, there's a counter-revolution. Those who represent the status quo will do everything they can to stop the revolution. That's always been the case. But revolutionaries or agents of change take strength from that. It's like a good martial artist. If you're up against someone who's bigger and stronger than you, you don't try to overpower them. You use their strength against them. And so the pushback is happening. The status quo is trying to stop this. It's trying to, you know, as you've said, they're trying to scare us into thinking we can't change, the economy will crash. No, a life economy will be so much better than a death economy. It'll employ lots of people. It isn't that we're going to go back and live in caves. It's that we're going to be doing jobs that'll make the planet a better place and make life a better place for all of us. So every one of your listeners, you and I, we're all very, very blessed to be alive at this time. And I'm not negating the terrible things people have experienced, the deaths of friends, family, or whatever, from the virus, the turmoil around white supremacy and Black Lives Matter and so on and so forth. But all of that, despite the pain, it's offering us the opportunity to open ourselves to a new level of consciousness. And as we do that, as we change our consciousness, we change our perceptions, we change our reality. And that's where we're headed right now. And so we should all feel very blessed to have this opportunity to be at this time.
You said the word pivotal. And when I was collecting my thoughts and about what my last words are, because I kind of make a joke of it, my mother would say to me, you always want to have the last word, Regina. And she was right, I do. But it ends up I don't really do that on the show. But I thought, what do I want to say? What do I want the takeaway for people that I know that tell me they listen to our shows and that they get something from it, they move forward or whatever? And my last words are about read this book. Really and truly read this book. It's riveting. It is a story, and you are in the story. That's the critical piece. If I can't find myself in a story, I'm not interested. And we are in the story. Take notes, stop, go deeper, share it with other people. And it made me realize again that they are not shaping history. We are shaping history at such a critical time on so many levels. And how do I want to show up? How do you want to show up as someone who wants to be a part of this, what could be a magnificent global shift? How do you want to help create a world that works for everyone? That means we all win. A world that respects Mother Earth, who is the source of all life. We have to remember that. We can never forget it for a day. And I, for one, do not have all the answers. But from where I sit, going through the exercise, journaling, asking myself questions on a regular basis is a great start. And to you, John, my heartfelt thanks, and I will get emotional. Your passion, your insights, your very big brain and your very big heart, and all that you're doing is making a difference for the planet and all of its inhabitants. And the reason I know that is because it made a difference for me. I can't go out and canvas the impact of touching the jaguar in people's lives, but you don't change the world. You start with a person, and you helped change my world. And I realized how blessed I am that you crossed my path, which has helped to inform my journey. And that's very deep within my heart. And my last thanks always goes to you, our amazing listeners, our tribe, our thoughtful, engaged human beings, because without you, there would be no us. And I invite you to do two things. Touch your jaguar and frickin' vote, because that is the power that we have in the next couple of weeks that will help with either a greater shift in one direction or a greater shift in another. And every show before November 3rd, I'm ending with, use your power, inform your decision, not just for president. So many more things are important at the local level than the president of the United States. So use your power, touch your jaguar, and if you want to, write and tell us about it, and I'll share it with John. So thank you, John. This was magical for me, and I appreciate it and you.
My pleasure, Gina. I love your final words and I love what you're doing. I honor what you're doing and thank you so much. Keep doing it.
Right back at you. You inspire me. So thanks, everybody, and make it a great, green, intentionally lived day, and touch your jaguar.